Podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In Podcast Network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Cinema Recall Podcast here at thatmomentin.com. I am your host, The Vern, and I am very excited to be talking about 2003's Kill Bill with my special guest, Kim Lo. Hello, Kim.
Hi. How's it going?
Hi. It's going good. Now, Kim, she writes for the site Tranquil Dreams, which you can find at killin.wordpress.com. I'm sorry, clean.wordpress.com. Am I saying that website right? I feel like I'm...
Well, I don't know. People always think it's killing, but it's just K-L-ling.
Okay, all right.
.wordpress.com.
But yeah, she's a great writer. She talks about food on her site, as well as travel places. She also does reviews about books, about movies. And she is one of the co-hosts of the Game War podcast. Kim, do me a favor, lady. Please tell me about, you know, everything that you do.
Well, I kind of do everything. I just really like versatility. So I try to cover everything, but obviously, like, you can't. It's impossible. So I do movies and books primarily right now. I'm starting, like, gardening stuff. I talk about, like, adventures. So I do mostly a lot of event coverage for Montreal and stuff like that. And, yeah, so, I mean, and I write gaming on Game Warp Podcast. Like, I write gaming at That Moment In, and at the same time, I run with Elwood Jones the Game Warp Podcast, and I do event coverage for gaming over on That Moment In.
You just do everything. That's, like, a whole wide list of, you know, events to do there. I can't keep any of that stuff straight there. Well, what got you into... you know, writing about, you know, doing things about the traveling and the food and also the game writing, what all?
Well, honestly, traveling and food, that was how the site started. That was how I actually got into it. I wanted to do more writing. I took it more originally as like a creative writing site and photography. Now my photography has moved to a second site, which is less active. I post pretty much 3 weeks of like 2 weeks of the month, I guess, when I remember and I have photos and I've gone out and actually done stuff. That's called Avenue of Daydreams. But like, yeah, so it started with that. And then afterwards I went ahead and I got inspired by, well, he doesn't write anymore, but I got inspired by Fogues from Fogues Movie Reviews. Back in the day. Yeah, so because of him, I actually started doing movie reviews, and then it eventually expanded to books because I'm more of a reader before I was, like, a really enthusiastic movie blogger sort of person.
Okay.
So, yeah, and then eventually the opportunity came last year where we were doing a collab, and I did my first show with Elwood Jones, and we worked together really well on the movie. And then he had told me he wanted to start something related to gaming. And he just didn't know where to start. And at that time, I had started writing for That Moment In for gaming. So I asked him, I was like, well, do you want to collaborate on something? And then he said, oh, well, let's do a podcast. And then I was like, oh, sure, let's give it a go. And that's what it's become now.
Yeah. And it's also cool, too, that, you know, not only do you guys have, you know, the audio podcast, which you can find on thatmomentin.com, you also have, like, a lot of, like, YouTube reviews as well.
Well, the original pitch right now is that, like, we don't do audio anymore, actually. We've actually cut that out completely. We only do YouTube. Our YouTube channel is our main focus now. So with the new YouTube channel now that we've... this year we started and we kind of moved off the That Moment In channel. It gives us kind of the space now. So we can do playthroughs other than our featured games. We can do things. So it can complement to other things that we're doing. And we can do game reviews. We can do interviews. And now everything's really like sorted out.
I mean, I watched a few of the Game Warp videos right there. Is that difficult to do, to edit the video footage?
It depends on what it is. Like, say, our E3 shows, those take a long time to do. I think they're more time consuming than it is hard to do.
Okay. All right, fair enough there. We'll definitely go onto YouTube, check out their video reviews for the games they do on Game Warp right there. I apologize immensely. I really thought there was still like a podcast going on there, but all right, there was before. You could listen to probably past episodes of Game Warp.
It's still a podcast. We call it a video podcast. So
okay.
We just do shorter shows now. So we do, like, when we do reviews, we do like 15 to 20 minutes usually. We hit about a 30-minute mark, even for the interviews, and we try to not exceed that unless it's like a really special show like E3 or something.
All right, very cool. Well, let's go ahead and take a small break right now. We're going to play some ads from some really good podcast shows, and then when we come back, we'll be discussing Kill Bill Volume 1.
We'll return after these messages.
Hey, what are you listening to?
Blood, Guts, and Blu-ray.
What's Blood, Guts, and Blu-ray?
You've never heard of Blood, Guts, and Blu-ray?
I've never heard of Blood, Guts, and Blu-ray.
Blood, Guts, and Blu-ray is a horror movie podcast. They talk about horror movies they love and even the ones they hate. They're actually really entertaining. You can listen to them on iTunes.
Well, what if I don't have iTunes?
Then you can find them on Stitcher or YouTube, or we could listen together.
Yeah, that sounds great. So, your place and mine.
Wait, did you hear that?
Hear what?
But I didn't even get a chance to listen to Blood, Guts, and Blu-ray.
Blood, Guts, and Blu-ray will never die, but you will. Listen now on iTunes, Stitcher, and YouTube before it's too late. Part of the Core Temp Arts Podcast Network.
Here's a few reasons why you should be listening to the Unwritable Rant podcast with host Juliet Miranda. She can tell a great story.
If you can't play dead, play drunk. And it works, I swear.
She interviews celebrities that have great stories.
If we have a cousin that's kind of strange, we don't put him away or tuck him away. We set him on an old dryer out in the front yard with alcohol and let him wave at people.
right, and then you tell your friends about it.
And she's tolerant and loves kids.
So these kids go running up after the ball, and I stand up and I yell, "Kids die in the street all the time!"
So head on over to theunwritablerant.com and listen to the show.
Everybody, welcome back to the Cinema Recall Podcast here at ThatMomentIn.com. Yes, we are here to discuss a few scenes from Kill Bill Volume 1. Now, Kim, is this the first time you saw this movie?
No, it's maybe the third or the fourth. I can't remember.
Do you remember where you were when you first saw this movie?
In the theaters.
You did see it in theaters.
Yeah, I saw it in theaters, and counting back to 2003, I was graduating high school, maybe.
Okay.
And I might have graduated high school at that point. So it was that same year, and at that point, I wasn't really a huge fan of these movies. I actually haven't seen any Tarantino at that point.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I remembered my cousins wanted to go, because they're older than me by a few years, and the funny story is I went in and I hated the movie so much. I went in and I thought it was a colossal, like, waste of my time for like 2 hours. I came out and I wanted to cry. Like, I was sitting there and I was like, when is this garbage gonna end? Why do people like this, you know?
Oh, okay.
Well, and now afterwards, I actually started watching it again a few years back, and I have a lot more appreciation for it. And I talked about it over on the MVDS Showcase, the special show where we did the movie deaths. And I was saying that I feel like Tarantino movies are very age-related. So, like, I appreciate it more as I have more experience with film and I appreciate the art of it. Whereas if you were younger and you watch this and you don't really care for much movies, then you're going to go for, like, bombs and explosions more than, like, the actual art style of stuff.
Kim's choice for a scene to talk about in Kill Bill was the sequence when the bride, played by Uma Thurman, meets Hattori Hanzo, played by Sonny Chiba. But before we talk about that scene, I'm just going to give you folks a quick little brief recap of the film. I'm pretty sure everyone has seen this before, but if you haven't, Kill Bill is about the bride, who is this elite assassin, you know, gets paid to go around the world and kill people. One day, she gets betrayed by her team and is left for dead, all right? And she wakes up a few years later with the taste of vengeance and blood, because when she was attacked, she was pregnant at the time, and they took her baby when she woke up, so she thinks that something happened to her, like her baby got killed. So yeah, she is a mom out for revenge. But she can't do it just yet. She actually has to go and get a sword from Hattori Hanzo himself.
Shut up! Get your ass out of here!
Excuse me. What are the Japanese? Do you know?
Oh, let's see. Arigato.
Arigato.
I already said domo, right?
Yeah.
Konnichiwa?
Konnichiwa. Konnichiwa. Please repeat.
Konnichiwa.
Perfect. Good. You say Japanese word like you're Japanese.
Oh, now you're making fun of me.
No. Serious business. Pronunciation very good. You say arigato? Like we say arigato.
Well, thank you. I mean, arigato.
You should learn Japanese. Very easy.
No kidding, I heard it was kind of hard.
Most difficult. But you have a Japanese tank. Okay. Omachi dosama. Oh my god. Kora! Oi! Agari doshita osoi! Isuke kora!
Nani nomu?
I beg your pardon?
Drink.
Oh, yes. A bottle of warm sake, please.
Warm sake? Very good.
Asukai-pon. And I have to ask you, Kim, why did you choose this sequence to talk about?
It's because of the contrast. Like, you can see this, the bride goes in, and she's kind of like this ditzy American. And then the scene changes so fast as she reveals, like, her true intentions of being there.
Okay, yeah. It's very kind of subtle, too, because when she first walks into the place, she doesn't know Japan at all. She knows, like, a few, you know, sayings, like domo and arigato, and she's playing it off very cutesy and innocent. I love the sequence when the bald guy comes in. I'm trying to remember his name right now. As you just call the bald guy, he's played by actor Kenji Oba. And he's talking about, you know, he doesn't want to bring her tea because he's watching the soaps. And I really like the kind of comedy banter that him and Sonny Chiba had in that scene. I kind of feel like they could have their own TV sitcom.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's really nice to have that break, you know, that comedic break. And that's something that Tarantino does so well. In finding, like, a perfect balance and having the sort of humor in his movies.
Yeah. And then after, you know, he said, the two ones through warm sake. And I liked the part, I liked it when Sanchipa was like, sake, very good. Oh, just great. And then the scene itself, when he asks her, you know, why she's there, and he and she says, you know, I'm trying to visit, you know, an old wise, you know, man. You know, I've never seen him before. And it's slowly revealed, like, her, the tone of the bride's voice, it becomes much more somber, and that's when she starts speaking full Japanese to tell him that, you know, she's there to find, you know, this great sword master. And then we found out, too, that Hattori Hanzo has stopped making weapons for a while, actually. For, gosh, only like 25 years or so. Mm-hmm. And he finds out that her quest is to find Bill. He helps her out. And I understand, too, that he wants to help her out. And that Bill was a former protege of his. But he knows damn well that she is going to use that sword to kill him. And I was kind of confused because I thought, well, if you were a guy that, you know, made these weapons for Bill, why would you mind that one of his, you know, workers is coming to kill him? Do you find that to be kind of a... Do you understand what I'm saying? Because he was, you know...
I understand what you're saying. But how I understand the situation is that he's fully aware that Bill has gone astray from, like... Because, you know, it feels like Hattori Hanzo is a very upright, like, a righteous man. He really has a lot of morals. He has a lot of rules that he sets for himself. And, you know, while he's proud of what he does, the reason is that he's proud of what he does, but he is retired. And he has rules as to, like, I'm retired, I'm not going to make these Japanese steel anymore. So, in the same context, you can think about it that, like, I didn't find it weird because I felt like he knew that Bill was doing things that he didn't like how he was acting.
Oh, okay.
So, he really felt like it was his responsibility to make the Japanese steel for the bride in order for her to kind of stop him.
Okay. I like that. I like that. It made sense right there. And then... So he decides to help her out with this making the sword. It's going to take a month. For me, what always draws kind of a tear to my eye is the sequence when he gives her the sword. And I really like the moment when he hands her the sword and he says, you go on your quest, you know, yellow-haired warrior. Which, in other director's hands, I feel like that line would seem as comedic, but in this one it doesn't. It seems genuine. And when she takes that sword and she says, you know, domo, it has a much different contrast than it did at the start of this of the scene when she first goes to the bar,
you know. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Because there is all kind of like comedic and, you know, saying Japanese phrases that we kind of like seen from other movies or songs, basically, you know, domo norigato, Mr. Roboto, is where I got, that's the only kind of Japanese I actually know. But yeah, I just really love that whole point there. But tell me, anything else you really love about the scene?
I think it would be kind of like, I guess it goes without saying that Tarantino picks his soundtracks really carefully. And yes. I think that the soundtrack here works really, really well. As in, like, I think just the moment of, like, I think the soundtrack really comes in when they go up and admire these katanas that he's made. And it's just all on the wall. And she walks up and this really, like, harmonious sort of orchestral music kind of thing goes on, and it's just really simple, but it really builds that mood of admiration for this art that he has on the wall, because katanas are kind of like an art form it's an art to make a beautiful katana, pretty much.
Oh yeah, no, definitely. And the sequence when, you know, yeah, he gives her that sword and you hear Zamfir for some odd reason right there. I mean, I remember seeing Time Life commercials of the best of Zamfir, and Zamfir is the guy with the pan flute, and the pan flute comes on, and then right when the drums start to kick in when she's given that sword, it just really has, like, I don't know, it kind of reminds me of a theme from, you know, like a 1970s or late 60s, like, Western, you know. It's got that type of good, strong, you know, feelings right there. I love the Hormana's vocals, too, when she actually does go up to the, when she goes to actually choose all the weapons, everything there, too. I just don't know what the name of that song is. The thing is, too, is that most of the soundtrack in Kill Bill Volume 1 is done from other movies. So I'm pretty sure this is done from another film, but I just really don't know what that one is right now. But yeah, I can't say anything more about the scene. It's kind of heartfelt. It's balanced very well. Yeah. Now, I have to ask you this, though, Kim. Have you seen any other Sonny Chiba films?
If you probably said the name, like, I don't know off the top of my head. He looks so familiar.
Well, I mean, Sonny Chiba, okay, so here's the connection that he has, you know, with the whole Tarantino universe.
Mm-hmm.
Is that in True Romance, Clarence Worley, played by Christian Slater, starts off a film that he's going to see a triple feature of Sonny Chiba movies.
Okay.
Street Fighter, Return of the Street Fighter, and Sister Street Fighter. So he was a star of, you know, many of those films. And then that's how when he appears as Rattari Zanzo, you know, it kind of connects those universes. Because apparently Kill Bill is a type of movie that characters from, like, True Romance and Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown, that's the kind of movies that would watch. They would watch, like, the Kill Bills, and they'd watch, like, the Django Unchained and the Inglourious Bastards. Those are the films.
You know, I actually remember where I know Sonny Chiba from.
What's that?
I know him from the Chinese franchise, Young and Dangerous. And it was in the later films, because that franchise runs for, like, 15 movies or something. So he's in the later ones in the, I would say, somewhere in the late 90s, maybe early 2000s, where he is a Yakuza boss, I think.
Ooh. Okay. Now, I remember hearing you on other shows here how you're a fan of the kind of Yakuza crime sort of movies, more compared to, like, you know, traditional, like, you know, mafia type crime movies.
Yeah, so, triads and Yakuza, I find, are a little bit more compelling to watch.
Okay. All right. So you were probably much more of a fan of Infernal Affairs than you were of The Departed.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was the show I did the MBDS on, so.
Okay, okay, good, okay. All right. Very nice, very nice. Well, yeah, I got nothing more to say about this right now. Let's go ahead and move on to another sequence there of the movie. And I'm going to cheat a little bit because I want to talk mainly about some of the fight sequences in the movie. I love the first one with the bride and Vernetta Green.
So I suppose it's a little late for an apology, huh?
You suppose correctly.
Look, bitch, I need to know if you're going to start any more shit around my baby girl.
You can relax for now. I'm not going to murder you in front of your child, okay?
That's being more rational than Bill led me to believe you were capable of.
It's mercy, compassion, and forgiveness I lack, not rationality.
I know I fucked you over. I fucked you over bad. I wish to God I hadn't, but I did. You have every right to want to get even.
No, 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 no. To get even? Even, Stephen? I would have to kill you. Go up to Nikki's room, kill her. Then wait for your husband, the good Dr. Bell, to come home and kill him. That would be even, Vernita. That'd be about square.
I do like the fight sequences between her and the bride and Gogo Yubari, played by, I'm gonna mess his name up here, Chike Kuinami, who a lot of people will recognize her from Battle Royale, and she is the girl in Battle Royale where you see her having a flashback of running, and then a kid comes up to her trying to position her for sex. He tries to attack her, and she kills him in the most brutal way ever. I think of all of, and then also the sequence too where she does fight Oren Ishii. But I'll ask, who was of course played by Lucy Liu. I don't know. I mean, I know we're kind of talking offline about this too, and you said you didn't much care for the film when you first watched it. And I'm watching it again. I mean, did you have more appreciation for the fight sequences? I mean, do you have a favorite fight sequence?
You see, that's the main thing was the first time I didn't like it was because I thought this was such over the top, you know, like the blood spurting out and all that stuff. Wasn't really like my wheelhouse. I just didn't like it. But now I really like it. I think that there's like, it adds kind of this like comedic value of it, I guess. And it works really well in that sense. I definitely appreciate it more.
Well, if I had to choose like any big fight sequences, I'm actually going to have us talk about, the end sequence where she is actually fighting the crazy 88s. All right. So she gets to the place of one of her, main, she's there to find Oren Ishii, who is part of the Deadly Viper Squad. They are part of the team that have betrayed her, so she's tracked her down. She's there. In fact, the whole sequence from the start, when she gets there to the end, is really amazing. I love the band that's playing in there, the 5678s. They do like this surfer rock music. I remember too when that song Woohoo became a big deal. I love the whole tracking shot of her going into the bathroom and Sophie Vitale going into the bathroom and she hears her in there. Love that part. And then the whole sequence with her fighting Gogo Yubari is great. In fact, I think that sequence of her fighting Gogo Yubari is really the only sequence where I thought, ooh, she's in real trouble here. I mean, she actually has something to lose. And I'm really so glad that they actually gave that character of Gogo, you know, a really strong presence in there. But yeah, I'm going to talk about the sequence where after she does take out Gogo Yubari, Oren Ishii brings in a whole slew of the Crazy 88s. I mean, she did fight a few of them before she fought Gogo, but now she's in real trouble here because she's actually there surrounded by tons of fighters. You don't know how the hell she's going to get out of it. And then she just goes on an onslaught. And I have to ask you, now I'm not quite sure, but what did you think about it when it suddenly turned from color to black and white? And I just want to hear just your general thoughts about that sequence.
I think it was really stylistic. Like the sudden change, really, I don't know, I guess it takes out that, you know, that corniness, but it kind of gives it that nostalgic feel.
Yeah.
And I really like the idea of how they did that. You know, you kind of end up focusing on a lot of the actions. You start focusing on different aspects of than if it was like, you know, the color and get really carried away by all the blood and all that stuff. Now it's just black and white. So you really like hone in on the action that's happening.
Yeah, you have a good point there too, because I know like in Japan, they show it with the color in there. They don't take the color out. And I know for like when it came to the US, the MPAA had it done so that it could receive an R rating. But I still think the film works definitely, like you said before, in a stylistic content because it turns from color to black and white. And it's still kind of cool how it's done. It's done when she puts out the eyes of, you know, one of the victims right there, which I thought was absolutely brilliant the way it just cuts to black and white. It seems like more of a director's choice than it being just censored.
Yeah.
If that made sense.
I think so. Oh. Yeah, it could be.
And then another thing, too, I was reading about this is that when a lot of, like, samurai movies or, like, ninja martial arts movies would come to the U.S., a lot of them were shown in black and white so they can get away with the violence on TV.
Oh, really?
Because there wouldn't be, like, a lot of, like, bloodshed or whatnot there, so they could actually show it on network TV. So, yeah. That's one thing that I kind of read about there. So it was more of a stylistic choice from the director instead of it just being, you know, another form of censorship, which I found to be very, very fascinating about the whole thing there. And I like the fact, too, that it goes to a close-up of her eyes and she blinks and then it comes back into color.
Yeah.
Which...
Yeah, that's true.
Is a very kind of cool thing, too. And then immediately it kind of cuts to, like, this, like, shadow, like, her, like, the silhouette of her with the sword, her long hair, and then everyone else having the short hair all surrounding her. And then the lights come on. She takes out the other guys really quick. And then she is the only one that's left standing is a small kid who really couldn't be any more than probably, would you say, 13, maybe 15?
Yeah.
You know? And he's just nervous as all hell. He's holding that sword, shaking, seeing all his friends around him, knowing that this could be his very last moments on Earth, all right? And she cuts down his sword into nothing because she has an Ettore Hanzo sword, which is the most badass sword ever made. And all she does is she just takes him and puts over her lap and just faints him a few times and tells him to go home. Brilliant. I love it.
It is. It's such a nice way. It's such a nice way to kind of bring such an intense scene and kind of like just pulls it back and makes it into this funny moment as it ends. Before you head into, like, you know, the intense battle that he's going to, that she's about to face.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that as well. I like the use of music in this. As we talked about music before, when she meets the Ettore Hanzo, I like how it goes from, like, this hip-hop style beats, because a lot of the music was composed by the RZA, and then it goes into old-school 60s, you know, rock and roll with, you know, Nobody Can Do It Like This.
That's one of the best things about this scene is the fact that you will notice this significant soundtrack that keeps changing. And I think it goes through during the whole fight. I think it goes through about four to five different songs, I believe. And then at the same time, you'll also have like the scene change. So you have the color and then you go to black and white and then you end it with this like blue tint shadowy thing and it just meshes so well together to show like the, I guess it's like kind of like a different stage in the fight.
Yeah. All right. Very cool. No, I definitely agree with that. I really don't know what to say more about the scene there. I do kind of, when this film came out, I was really kind of disappointed that it didn't pick up any Oscar love. I really was. I really thought Uma Thurman as the bride was fantastic. I think she's more fantastic in the second one than she is in this one. But I was still really kind of upset that she never won or was not even nominated for an Academy Award. And, you know, I gotta pull this up right now. So the 2003 Academy Awards, let's see now, we had for Best Actress, we had Nicole Kidman in The Hours. We had Selma Hayek in Frida. Diane Lane in Unfaithful. Julianne Moore in Far From Heaven. And Renee Zellweger in Chicago. And I would have removed Diane Lane from Unfaithful.
Yeah, me too.
And put Uma Thurman as the bride. I think maybe the Academy doesn't really recognize action stars as being dramatic, you know, characters. But I really thought she was really good in this movie, especially the sequence when she wakes up and she's fully, slowly, you know, realizing where she is, and she looks down at her belly, realizes that her child is missing. I mean, that's just, for me, really gut-wrenching stuff. And even the sequence, too, when she's fighting Orenishi, of course, played by Lucy Liu, and Orenishi says to her, you know, for making fun of you earlier, I apologize. And just the look on her face when she accepts her apologies, there's just so many different layers right there, you know, like, because I have a feeling that she is going after these people and taking revenge on them for what they did to her, but yet there's a sense of kind of heartbreak when she does, because she definitely does have a sense of respect for these people, which I find to be very much different than your standard revenge action film.
Yeah, well, there's a lot more planning, right? There's a lot more planning, yeah. And she used to, you know, she is an assassin, you know, before all this started, and she, you know, she has a connection to these people. She knows all these people that, you know, have kind of turned on her. So there is, like, some sort of, you know, you can see that the best when she fights the lady, the first one, Vivica Fox.
Yeah, Vivica Fox, Vernetta Green.
Yeah, exactly, Vernetta Green. You can know that, like, you can see from that scene that, you know, there's sort of, there's a lot more connection in there. You know, you can see that there is a prior friendship to this and a certain amount of, like, a difficulty to killing her. But at the same time, like, obviously the scene turned out that, you know, that she did die. But, I mean, like, you can see just from that scene how there is a connection. And I think that you make a very fair point in that, like, I would definitely remove Diane Lane from Unfaithful. Not that I didn't like Unfaithful. I just think that that movie was a little cliche in many ways. And it wasn't particularly like a role that I think anybody could have done really well if they were a decent actress. But the deal with Uma Thurman and why, like, you make a fair point about action films. And I think this one had a lot of comedy in it. And a lot of these movies tend to get kind of brushed aside when they're considered for Oscar nominations. But at the same time, if you think about it, this is a very heartbreaking role. Uma Thurman has a very dramatic character because, you know, just from, that scene of her waking up and embracing all these emotions and having to do, this is actually a very, you know, despite from all these comedic moments that happen, it is still a very dark movie to go through.
Yeah.
So there is definitely depth to her character, and she definitely did deserve it. Now I watch it, of course I say I deserve it. I think she deserves it.
Yeah, I mean, I just, like, watching the thing right there, and I knew that she probably would never win, but I was really kind of hoping that she would at least get, you know, something, some sort of awards right there. In fact, I'm just looking this up right now, and I don't think that, she was nominated for, like, a Golden Globe Award, so that was good. She was nominated for a Golden Globe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For Best Actress right there, so I was really hoping that she would actually pull through, but she was nominated for, you know, a BAFTA, which is, of course, the kind of the British version of the Academy Awards, and she was nominated for Best Leading Role right there for the BAFTAs, I think she was, she won the, of course, the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films, you know, which is, you know, pretty standard right there, Austin Film Critics, but I really would have loved to see, like, an action star like that, get nominated, because it would have been kind of the second time, I think the only other time that a female action star was nominated was Sigourney Weaver in Aliens.
But you see, like, the possibility of it, I don't think you're going to ever see it again.
Yeah, I know. Well, maybe, I'm wondering, too, if, like, Wonder Woman will get some noms for actors and that.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, it is, I haven't seen Wonder Woman yet, but I've heard that she makes a very phenomenal Wonder Woman, and she does, like, a fantastic job. So, we'll see, right? I mean, the nominations are a few months away.
Yeah, I know. We got many times before that too happens there. But Yeah, all right. So I have to ask this too. I mean, of course, I'm sure you've seen Volume 2.
I have, much less than Volume 1, though.
Okay. I was going to ask you, too, do you prefer one or the other?
I think for me, I don't remember much of Volume 2. It's been a few years since I've seen it. But I always remember scenes from Volume 1 more. I think it's just the fact that there's a lot more familiar faces there.
Yeah. I hear that. Yeah. Oh. Yeah, and I like the fact, too, I mean, that, well, definitely Volume 2 runs, you know, a little bit longer. But for me, I have to watch both these movies back-to-back, because to me, it's just one long movie, because I want to see the continuation of a story. And of course, you know, the first one is more of an homage to, you know, Japanese action films, samurai films, a lot of references to, I don't know the right word here, but there's kind of a... It's more over the top. Very, it's that anime in there.
Yeah.
Where you find about, you know, what happens to Orinishi Lee. There's like a whole like Brian De Palma style sequence there. It's a lot of style in this one. And then Volume 2, you get more into the heart of it. You know, you find out more about, you know, how the bride became the bride. You also find out her real name. I found it brilliant, too, when they, every time they say the bride's real name, they bleep it out.
Yeah.
Which I found would be brilliant there. The second one, for me, feels more like a Western. And the first one is definitely more of, like, a kung fu, exploitation, grindhouse samurai film.
Yeah, I think I, like, from my brief memory of it, I remember Volume 2 being really long and maybe slow-paced a little.
Oh, yeah.
Like, see, that's the thing, is I have that same issue with, I never remember the name. What's that last movie that Tarantino did?
Oh, The Hateful Eight.
Yeah, Hateful Eight. I didn't like Hateful Eight. I'm not very well versed in Westerns. I've seen like one Western, Unforgiven. I don't have any appreciation for it. I think it's really slow. I think it's, you know, once things start getting getting a move on and starts getting into the plot and like things start moving forward, it gets interesting. But the grind of moving past that is just so painful. I remember Volume 2, like, I had a few scenes, I believe there's that nurse, right? She actually fights the nurse in this Volume 2.
Yeah, El Driver, played by General Hannah.
Yeah, see, I remember that, and I really like that character. I remember that part, and I think that's the only part I actually have vague memories of in Volume 2. I'm not a big fan of it because of, like, maybe that's why, because you said it's more of, like, a Western style, and I'm not really into that, whereas, like, Volume 1 is more, like, fast-paced. There's a lot more action. There's a lot more familiar faces. Like, even the leader of Crazy 88 is an actor that I truly, truly love and have admired since, like, Hong Kong TV series and Hong Kong movies, and he's so well-known in Hong Kong, you know? Yeah. Like, it's sad that he's you know, he's retired now. But, you know, he's a great martial artist.
All right. So I do have to ask you this, Kim, because I know nowadays there's been a lot of talk about women starring in more action-oriented roles or more superhero films, especially with Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman. And there's been nothing but support of the film, which I really appreciate it, though. But... did you feel that The Bride was a good role model for women when the film came out?
Like, you know, the idea of feminism and all these things and just, you know, giving stronger roles to women was definitely not something that I would think about. I mean, I'm raised in a Chinese family. It's not, you know, there are still traditions that we tend to, you know, I also have kind of like an older style family. So their mindsets are a little bit like, obviously the newer generation doesn't have that, but it's not, you know, we don't talk about it. Like when the film first came out, it definitely doesn't, you know, it wouldn't have come to my mind. 03, I was like, what, 16? So you don't really have that kind of mentality of feminism and just, you know, like, oh, women role models, you know? You don't have that. Definitely now, she's much more of a role model. I feel that, you know, the character is really strong-willed. I think that's one of the things that, you know, you can take away from that character is, you know, she's so strong. But at the same time, there is this issue of, I find, where female, you know, as I talk about this, you know, there's always this issue of making females strong from going through something very tough. You know, like, they always have to go through something that someone else has inflicted on them. I don't know if that makes sense. You know, like, you always seem to put women in, like, oh, strong women come out from, you know, after they survived being raped or being, you know, some sort of losing a child or something, you know? Some sort of...
Something traumatic has to happen.
Exactly.
To them.
And they're not, you know, like, say, Wonder Woman. I don't know the story very well, but I kind of have a general idea. I don't think anything traumatic happens to her. But she's a strong female character because she... you know, finds the strength in her to be more. You know, so that's why I think that, you know, say for Wonder Woman, she's more of an iconic female and like a role model than say someone like Uma Thurman's character who has to suffer some sort of traumatic event in order to find that strong will. But I do think she is very strong in the sense that, you know, like, say she has that strong mentality where, you know, not everybody, obviously this is fictionalized, but not everybody will have that sort of mentality to be like, oh, you know, it's been like X amount of years that she's been in a coma or something, and then she gets up and then she drags herself to the car, and then she's like, oh, wiggle your toes, you know, wiggle your toes, you know, and then it just goes, you know. And obviously, you know, you don't have that sort of there's definitely some sort of strong will and some sort of mentality that you need to have when you're, you know, in that character. And that's why I kind of like that character in those moments.
Sure. Yeah, I have a feeling, too, if the bride wasn't portrayed by her former co-workers, I think that she actually would have become a big hero, because in Volume 2, you do find out the real reason why she was attacked, because she actually was trying to get out of the life. You know, she's going to be pregnant, having a child right there. She wanted out of it. So I have a feeling that if that sequence never happened to her, she definitely would have found the strength to maybe, you know, take out Bill anyways, because she didn't really agree with the whole killing for money aspect right there. She actually wanted to use her skills and powers for good. So
yeah, she wanted to be more. She wanted to be more for herself. And
yeah.
And yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, once you say, like, if you just based it on Volume 1, she's not, you know, she's not really, she is still a great character, but she lacks that sort of role model female character. Whereas if you put, like, both the volumes together, it's a much more complete story. And you kind of see, like, obviously the reasons behind why she wants to do that. And, it's hard to say. She's a very difficult and she is a very complex character to really pinpoint whether she would be, you know. On one side, you know, like, if we said she is, you know, like, oh, you know, she's a really iconic female lead, like someone that, you know, you would look up to in that sense. Well, no, because you'd be like, well, you don't want someone who's so full of vengeance in that sense, you know. That's a, you know, hateful thought. Someone's run by vengeance. But at the same time, like, you know, there are aspects of her character which makes her, you know, the phenomenal, outstanding person that is able to let her complete this task.
Yes. Okay. I like that. I like that a lot, Kim. That's some deep shit right there.
I'm a thinker. That's what I do. I sit at home and I think a lot.
I like it. You definitely brought more thoughts into my brain from that character right there too. Especially the notion that in most other films, women have to be the victim before they can become the hero, which has become kind of a cliche now. And I do think with Kill Bill Volume 1, that is sort of the case. And then when you watch Volume 2, it kind of balances out very well. I've got nothing else to say about these movies. I enjoy them a lot. I think I have to watch this movie at least once a year or so. I love the style of it, though. I kind of want The Bride to come back. I want there to be a Deadly Viper Squad animated show. I totally want that. I want to see like an animated show where The Bride and her other teammates have to go around the world. And it would be sort of like a Mission Impossible, but with a lot more fighting. And, you know, instead of, you know, a Mission Impossible, they're trying to, like, you know, retrieve something. No, in the Deadly Viper Squad, they're going around town to kill people. They have different targets they have to take out, and how they do it, you know, yeah.
That sounds like a really great graphic novel series.
It does, yes. Oh, gosh, gotta get on that, though. Well, again, Kim, thank you so much for, you know, being on the Cinema Recall podcast to talk about Kill Bill Volume 1. Can you tell me, you know, what's happening, anything new happening with the Game Warp, with you and Elwood? Any new shows you guys are doing, or any new, food dishes you're writing about on your site? Plug away.
Game Warp will be having our upcoming review. Is our featured game is Firewatch, and we're going to be reviewing that soon. We have an interview coming up with a game dev who also is an upcoming game in September. I think it's an indie game, obviously. As for my site, there is, you know, the hiatus for my Battle of Ingredients is over. Our summer hiatus is done. Both me and my co-host, my co-collaborator, Phoebe, we're back at it. We're going to be getting our Battle of Ingredients night in, and we're going to have that done. It'll be a barbecue edition for the summer that we missed.
Well, all right.
Generally,
then.
That's it.
Okay, very cool. All right. Now, what we do on every episode of Cinema Recall is we have a poll of 5 movies to choose from. And I think what we're going to do for our next episode, because Logan Lucky just came into theaters, the new movie from Steven Soderbergh, I think we're going to do a scene from a heist movie. So yeah, the topic is going to be heist movies. And your 5 choices for heist movies are going to be Inside Man from 2006. We're going to do The Town from 2010. We're going to do Dark Day Afternoon from 1975. We're going to do The Killing from 1956. And then our last choice, I think, is going to be, let's do it. Let's do Point Break. All right. So those are your 5 choices here. Go on to thatmomentin.com and vote what would be the best heist film. All right. So, Point Break, The Killing, Dark Day Afternoon, The Town, and Inside Man. And whichever one of those has the most votes, we'll talk about a scene or scenes from that film. I feel like, am I leaving out any heist films that you would put in there, Kim?
Fast 5.
Okay. All right. thank you very much. Kim, where can the fine listeners here get caught up with you? Are you,
my website is klling.wordpress.com. My Twitter is at Tranquil Dreams. Replace the E with a 3 because they used that thing before. And that's about it.
Okay. And of course, you can definitely check out all episodes of the Cinema Recall podcast on the site thatmomentin.com. Follow us on Twitter. We are at thatmomentin. I am on Twitter. Just type in at Video Vanguard. Again, Kim, thank you so much for everything. I appreciate being on the show. Will you ever come back to us?
Anytime.
All right, I appreciate that. All right, everybody. Let's take care of everything for tonight now. Take care.